little bit late, but this is beginning the TechNet. I just came down from the tower where I'm installing an antenna, and I thought I'd have another antenna operational tonight, but not yet. Made some progress. One of the things I've discovered is that the way Channel Master programs the directions on their antenna movers, antenna changers, let's put the word for it, antenna rotators. Boy, they've got it crazy. They tell you to set everything south, and when it calibrates it, when it calibrates itself, it does so by setting 0 degrees as south, which of course is a little bit crazy. Considerable delay. K2RIW testing. Okay, this is TechNet number 4125 in the numbering system that began in September of 1982 when the first TechNet occurred. KC2WGB, John, you've already heard him, and I, K2RIW, tried to run this thing that we think is an educational gathering that's been around now for 30 years, would you believe, as of last September. Because of what's going on in New York City, because of that megastorm, or was it sometimes called a Frankenstorm, I know that an awful lot of what we'll be discussing tonight will be survival techniques, information, generators, wiring of houses. It's going to be one of the major subjects. Everybody who experienced a power outage, let me drop this. Everybody who experienced a power outage, and there was, what, 950,000 people on Long Island, 2.5 or so million people in the whole tri-state area. One of the major things we experienced, if you're not right on the shore and your house was completely washed away and your relatives near drowned or in some cases really drowned, if that didn't happen to you, the thing that affected us most is being out of electrical power. So the natural response to that is, okay, I'll get a generator. At the instant you make a decision that you're going to get a generator, you would be amazed how many things that you're entering in the decision of. How big, which one of the four fuels, and in other words, by how big is it going to be a so-called fleet power generator of, roughly a kilowatt? Is it going to be roughly 2 kilowatts? Is it going to be 10 kilowatts, 15 kilowatts? There are lots of people who have sufficient economic resources, and they think, okay, I want to make sure that it's big enough. There's some extremely strong disadvantages to making the generator big enough. This is one of those situations in life where actually underpowering has more advantages than advantages, opposite of common sense. Once you decide you're going to have a generator, you're then going to have to decide, how am I going to fuel it? Natural gas, gasoline, liquid propane, diesel fuel. How am I going to hook it up to the house? There's lots of different ways of doing that. The one extension cord technique, the two extension cord technique, the simple backfeeding technique, the more complicated backfeeding technique, the transfer switch and subsets of transfer switch. Or am I going to create electrical power by way of 12-volt or 24-volt batteries and an electronic inverter, a transistorized circuit that gives me power? Or am I going to somehow do it for my automobile? Where's the fuel going to come from to run it for days on end?
And repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Another one of the things that you really worry about when you don't have electrical power is the main safety thing that we all have these days is a telephone. You'd be amazed how necessary a telephone is. If a life-threatening situation occurs, somebody gets, like a good friend of mine, for instance, what happened to that person was that they their wife had hot water. In other words, the hot water had been reestablished in the house, but not the heat, and the person took a shower. After coming out of a moist shower and being hit with the cold air of the house, that created a, what do you call that situation where a person's throat closes off, all of a sudden they can't think of it. Give me a hint on that one, John. Asthma. So the person suddenly had an asthma attack coming out of a hot, warm shower, and breathing the cold air of the house. That man's wife died from that event. When you hear situations of people who are in a house and water is slowly rising in the house, if the water in the house, whether it be fresh water or salt water, and salt water is particularly bad on this one, if the water in the house touches any one single electrical outlet, and if you're in that water, your life is at a lot of risk of electrocution. And quite a few people died from that one. So we so rarely have an event like that. Water coming into the house, rising to the level where it touches the fuse box in the basement, or it touches the circuit breaker box in the basement, or it touches any one of the electrical outlets in the house. That's an extremely dangerous situation. Let me drop. The next thing you got to worry about is, since the telephone is such an extremely important safety device, how do you make sure you've got telephone service? For economic reasons, a number of us have chosen things like internet telephone and a cable television type telephone. Well, the cable system operates by way of 14 amplifiers per mile, and every one of those amplifiers during every one of those miles has to be powered. Otherwise, that chain is broken and you have no cable television and no telephone. Some people have internet telephone. Well, the internet telephone requires the computer in your house to be running and for it to have connection to an internet service that is functioning. Some of us have ordinary twisted pair wire telephones, and if they get flooded out, they stop working. I, for instance, have a fiber optic, VIOS-type telephone. That's being maintained by an electronic circuit in my house being powered by a battery power supply that converts the sound from the handpiece into a fiber signal, an optical signal that goes down the fiber. Well, that battery goes dead in 6 or 8 hours. So there's a zillion ways you can use loose telephone. If you think you've got, let me drop. You think you've got cell phone service, and a high number of people don't worry about how long does the cell phone work. I mean, we like to buy a cell phone. It's got all kinds of horns and whistles. It's basically a laptop computer, or it's a desktop computer in your hand. Well, as you add more and more functions that draw more and more current, and we demand smaller and smaller cell phones, there's less and less battery power there. There are certain kinds of cell phones that can only operate for about 4 hours before the battery goes dead. If you buy a bare-bones telephone, like my son uses cell phone, he can operate for most of a week on that battery. So there's a huge difference there. The battery itself, is it a replaceable thing? In most of the modern-day cell phones, the battery is glued in, it's not replaceable. Okay, how are you going to recharge it? You can't plug it into the wall if the wall doesn't have power. A high percentage of the people don't know that you can buy for about $20 an auxiliary item that allow you to charge the cell phone from the car battery, from the cigarette lighter. And so tremendous numbers of people were lining up in all kinds of places in New York City trying to charge their cell phone. After the cell phone is charged, how do you know you're going to make a cell call? If the cell site doesn't have an operational T1 line or the equivalent, which is a fiber optic-like thing, and if the cell site doesn't have power, some of them only have batteries that operate for like 6 or 8 hours, and if it's got a standby generator, only a certain number of them have standby generators, and the standby generator has been run on oil fuel. How much oil fuel is there? How many days is that going to run? So there's lots of ways the cell phone can fail, the thing that's in your hand. The cell site you must talk to can fail, and that's out of your control. So just maintaining that life-protecting thing called telephone is an interesting thing to worry about. As you can see, there's a lot more to this situation than first meets the eye. We're learning some very painful lessons. Guarantee this is going to be some of what we'll be discussing tonight. I made myself just a little bit of a checklist of other things that you've got to consider when you decide to...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
When you decide you're going to have an auxiliary source of power and ways of maintaining it, and ways of maintaining its battery, and ways of maintaining its fuel, and ways of hooking it up to your house, and so on, lots and lots to learn. By way of the nets that Rich, K2KNB, and other people, and John were running throughout the last couple of weeks, lots and lots of information got passed. And so, in fact, I've even heard people say they wished some way had existed for recording all of that. When it comes to the technical nets, yes, they are recorded. And they're available by going to that website being maintained by KC2NJI. website. You can go to is amateur radio, www.amateurradio.tangovictor, and you can listen to 6 solid years of TechNet if you are so motivated. And some people do that because there's an awful lot of good information that has been contributed by people signing in from the tri-state area. What we're probably going to try to do tonight is there will be questions and answers on all of the above. A little bit of ham radio during the first hour. Probably we'll go to a couple of contacts from the mailbag. If Paul WS2N has got something that he can tell us that took place by way of National Aeronautics and Space Administration, we'll go to that. After that, I think we're going to get deeper into the area of safety type of wiring, auxiliary power, and things along those lines is what I believe are going to be the major subject tonight. If we exhaust all of those subjects and everybody is satisfied with that, then we'll go into other subjects. But I think it's going to be primarily simple ham radio questions and methods of establishing emergency communication and emergency power. A person signs into the technical net by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So anyone would like to check in tonight, giving us their call letters and name, because they do have a question or a comment, please do so right now. K2LIW listening.
JF Vito Bayshore.
Vito recognized.
This is KC2QYW. My name is Joe. No.
Okay, QIW, I think that was Joe, and I think you did say no. Anyone else? Check in. Give me your call letters and name right now.
Whiskey, Whiskey 2, Whiskey, Whiskey, yes.
I should know your name. Whiskey, Whiskey 2, Whiskey, yes. Tell me your name again, sir.
It's Tim, Dick.
Okay, Tim, we got you. So we got, when it comes to people with a question or a comment, we so far have Vito and Tim. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
B2BH1.
Paul, with a space report.
Okay, we got Jim. And we got Paul with a space report. Okay, anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
C2COW colon, yes.
Okay, a colon, something W. Give me the call letters again, colon.
C2COW.
Sounds like COW, like cow. Charlie Oscar Whiskey, colon. Okay, we got you. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
N2LDY? No.
Okay, I heard the no. LDY, I should know you very well, but it's on another page. Tell me your name, sir.
Don, Delta, Oscar, November.
Okay, we got you, Don. And do we miss anybody so far? So far I've got, with people with real questions or comments, I've got Vito, Tim, Jim, Paul, Colin, and Don. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. We have more than enough to get stuff going. Vito, WH2PJF. How did the world treat you in Bayshore? Lucky for you and I, we're on relatively high land, so we didn't get flooded out, but I know darn well you lost power. Everybody did. And I was out for 4 days living on a generator. And I wonder how you fared, power-wise and telephone-wise, Vito. WA2, Papa Juliet Foxtrot, K2RAW. You got it, Vito.
Okay, Dick, I have a cold. I apologize. There was a comment you made there briefly about backfeeding panels. That's a no-no. The only real way that's the proper way to set up your generator auxiliary power for your home is to a generator transfer unit, which you had mentioned, which is it's very simple wiring, but it's time consuming. The backfeeding idea is not recommended because a lot of people say, well, I'm going to open the breaker, double pole breaker, and I will eliminate the facilities from outside and there's no problem, but that's not true because there are three legs involved here. Even though it's phase A and B, which is really only single phase, but it's called single phase, but you're breaking two different legs, the neutral is still intact, and the neutral is covered because it carries current. And down, that back feeding can carry current through the neutral leg out to the pole. And the power guy out there working, let me drop. The power guy working out there assumes that all power has been shut down for his safety, and all of a sudden we have a neutral leg carrying source back to him. The only real way, if you want to do back feeding, is I recommend very strongly a three-pole pull box, which will break legs A and B and neutral wired through the pull box. And then when doing that, my dad had it in his house in his basement to isolate everything from outside, and then you can do what you want inside, it's your call. Or reach up into the fuse panel and remove the neutral leg and fold it back. That's the only time you can use the back feeding through the dryer, a receptacle, or the stove. Or even putting a double pole breaker in the run and feeding it that way. But really, a generator transfer unit is so designed that all of these issues are covered through this unit. And should a situation prevail outside, you're legally not responsible because you have the proper equipment. It's very in-depth. It's very lengthy conversation on this, but just a quick note because we have people at Home Depot that come in and give me a hard time. And let me drop. And I have a lot of knowledge in this category, in this area, if I may blow my own horn. And I get comments like, you're wearing an orange apron, what do you know? So I very nicely and gingerly say, gentlemen, or sir, with all due respect, what I have forgotten about this topic, you have yet to learn, so don't you dare put me down. But I'll try to help you, but a lot of them are thick-headed, and they give you aggravation, but they want to do what they want to do, and it's amazing that most of these homes haven't burned down. So anyway, I'm sorry to hang on here. I just can't talk anymore. Back to you, Dick. WA2PJF is by for you.
Very fine, Vito. Vito, as you guys know, is an employee of Home Depot. Home Depot gives quite a number of instructional classes as to how to properly use equipment. Vito is one of the few guys that enjoys going to those classes, enjoys getting the information. I suspect some of the employees say, oh, why do I have to take a class? Why can't I just plain work here? And Vito is absolutely right. When you decide to back feed a house, as many electronic enthusiasts do, I'm telling you that I am not recommending you do it. I'm just telling you that I did do it. And yes, for the time being, I've gotten away with it. But it is not the recommended procedure. It does not obey the electronic code. And if you create a fire or some other damage in the house, there's a chance that your insurance company no longer covers you because you did something that is opposite of code. The right way to do it is with a transfer switch. And the Cadillac approach to that, if you've got 200 ampere service, so to speak, is to have a 200 ampere rated transfer relay, a relay that when you flip it, relay or switch, when you flip that transfer switch, it simultaneously disconnects you from LIPA or Con Ed or New Jersey Power and Light or Connecticut Power and Light and connects you to the generator. And unfortunately, that's quite a few $100s for that switch, and quite a few of us think we're only going to need it once per decade, and it's kind of difficult to make that cost installation. The alternates that we heard by way of the guys who signed in last week from Canada, we heard from Scott, VE3ZTZ, and we also heard from Jim, VE3JIW, that the alternate approach is that there is an aftermarket device. Let me drop. There is an aftermarket device, and we believe in many counties it is accepted by the code, which is kind of a mechanical slide device, which when it's connected, when it's screwed down to your circuit breaker panel, one of the apertures picks up the lever mechanism of your main circuit breaker. Another aperture on the slide mechanism picks up the auxiliary circuit breaker that you add, which allows you to have connection to your generator. Therefore, when you flip it in one direction, it enables the generator connection to the house and automatically disconnects the main circuit breaker between you and the LIPA or Con Ed. And so that is a less expensive approach, which because most of the generators we're going to choose are somewhat limited in power, in the vicinity of wiring-wise, will be enabled by the circuit, and it doesn't have to have the whole 200 ampere capability. You're going to play power czar, and you're going to control what appliances turn on. You're going to be instructing the members of your household, do not turn on everything at once. If you do, you're going to stall the generator outside, or you're going to create the tripping of the circuit breaker of the generator outside. The generator outside, bear in mind that even if you had, let's say, a 4-kilowatt generator, let me drop. If you had one of the popular brands, a 4-kilowatt generator, which has, in most cases, a pair of 110-volt output circuits, as well as a 240-volt output circuit, and if you make one simple extension cord connection between that generator and you bring that extension cord into the house, which is, according to code, the simplest approach is to take a rather heavy-duty extension cord from the generator, and the generator is, let me pick a number, 20 feet away from the house, always running outdoors, far from the house, so that the carbon monoxide coming out of the generator doesn't have a chance to blow back into the house. Certainly, you're never, never going to run the generator in the basement or in the garage. And so there are people who are very tempted to do that for fear that, that they have to protect it from theft, or they want to keep it out of the rain. Don't worry about that. Find some other way of chaining it down, so to speak, 20 feet away from the house. But it's an outdoor machine. Only run away from the house because of the carbon monoxide, because of the fuel, and whatever. So the safe way, simple way, is you run an extension cord, heavy-duty extension cord, from that back through an open window or an open door, partially open window or door, and you power up the refrigerator and other appliances to give you some creature comfort, like television set and light. However, that approach does not power up, in most cases, your furnace or your hot water heater. And so something more elaborate's got to be done. And now you're getting into the techniques of transfer relay, partial transfer relay, or backfeeding. The main thing you've got to do is disconnect you from your house from the rest of the system. That's what happens when you trip the main circuit breaker. You got to make double darn sure that the main circuit breaker cannot inadvertently be put back into the active mode while the generator is connected. It's not a disaster, but you could create significant damage of the generator if you did.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Now, Vito feels that the third lead of the power wiring between the utility transformer out in front of your house that brings you, that steps the, let me pick a number, 13.2 kilovolts, which is the main distribution voltage down many streets, at least down my street, and the transformer converts that down to 240 volts with center tap, and those three wires, left side, right side of that secondary winding plus the center tap, is what's brought into your house. And that center tap, the so-called ground lead, is supposed to be grounded at the telephone pole, at the utility pole, by something called a butt plate. Also, that exact same wiring is common to the grounding system, the safety wiring system of your fuse panel, which in turn is usually grounded to other grounding rods and or the water pipe of your house. Now, Vito feels that you must disconnect the red and the black lead going back to the transformer. Absolutely true. Vito feels that you should also disconnect the third lead to that transformer. And that one's a little bit more controversial. If the transformer is properly wired with its own ground, if your fuse panel is properly wired with the water pipe ground in your house, whether that third wire between you and the telephone pole transformer is connected is not a problem. However, there are cases where the telephone pole has been hit a couple of times, the rewiring of the telephone pole was not done correctly, the grounding of the transformer was not done by way of the butt plate, you're one of the few houses that's connected to that particular transformer. And now, in that particular situation, that wiring between that transformer and you could, because of the way the primary of the transformer operates with 13.2 kilovolts, there is a slim chance that with improper grounding somewhere in the system, that a good fraction...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
There is a possibility that a good fraction of the 13.2 kilovolts can appear in your house. And one of the stories that we've heard that happened happens a few times per year in various places in the United States, is that the main water valve coming into your house doesn't completely close off. It has a slow leak to it, and you hire a plumber to replace your main water valve coming into the house. By one means or another, he unsolders that thing from the water pipe, and at the instant he separates the two water pipes, the one coming in from the street and the main water pipe that's in your house, at the instant he separates the two, with improper wiring and improper grounding of the power system coming into your house, there is the possibility that 13.2 kilovolts appears across those two pipes, and therefore those two pipes in the hand of the plumber becomes a source of electrocution. A really smart plumber makes sure that there is an extremely heavy grounding cable, a clip lead, let's call it, but a very heavy-duty clip lead, between both halves of that pipe at the instant he's separating them to protect him from that situation. If he's really smart, he puts a clamp-on ammeter on that pipe and measures whether or not there is common mode current flowing through the pipe, which gives him another clue that something is improper in the system. As you can tell, once you start digging into the wiring of your house, and you as not as an electronic, a licensed electrical contractor, lots and lots of dangers take place. And so Vito is giving us some hints about that one. Lots to be considered by just finding other ways of creating auxiliary power in your house. There's probably a couple more things that you want to mention on this one, Vito, so I'm going to pass it back to you. WA2PJF, thank you for your info. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. You covered all the important topics, and everything you said is 100% correct. Just in the interest of being doubly safe, as you said, if all these facilities were not properly in place on the pole, then there's a danger of that neutral leg being still connected. The neutral leg is used to balance the phase A and phase B, if I use that language. It keeps it balanced. If you didn't have a neutral, then one side would be maybe 150 volts, the other side would be 50. So the neutral is very, very important, but it does carry current, and we use that word current, and that's why it's covered. It's called the grounded ED leg. Then we have the grounding ING, the bare wires, which are used for static electricity on surfaces and things of that nature. I want to mention one more thing before I go. You mentioned about generators. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Generators. Well, for example, a 4kW generator has the facilities, I use the word facilities, of 33 amps available to be drawn when needed, a maximum of 33 amps. If you want to use a 5kW, it would be 41 amps, and a 6kW would be 50 amps, and et cetera, et cetera. If you were to purchase a generator transfer panel, we have the 30 amps, 40, the 50, and so forth and so on. You would first buy the generator, and then when you know how many kW you have in the generator, let me drop. When you know the generator size and what power is available to be consumed by this by the load, then you will buy the appropriate generator transfer unit. There's no point in buying a 50-amp unit when you only have a 33-amp generator. So the other thing, they work together as sets, as pairs. So very, very important. I would recommend everybody nothing less than even more than a 5, maybe a 6 or a 7 kW generator, which will give you the luxury of powering your oil burner, two refrigerators, the lighting, TV room, and so forth, which is ideal because, like I said, this is more, as you know, current is drawn and voltage is applied. That's why it's called EMF, electromotive force. It forces the current, it pushes the current to do the work. The current does all the work. The current is lazy. It has to be nudged. That's why the EMF, where it comes into the picture. And together, they perform work done measured in watts or power. But these generators are very, very important. And the higher the kilowatt rating, the more useful it would be for you. to be used in your home. Back to you, Dick.
Now, what Vito is expressing is one of the very popular techniques of deciding what size generator you're going to have, because you add up all the things in the house you want to run, and therefore you come up with some number of kilowatts. If, for instance, you chose a 4-kilowatt generator, which was a very popular size, I was involved with 550 of them being installed on Long Island right after Hurricane Gloria. 4 kilowatts, so let's call it 4,000 volt amperes, on a 120-volt circuit would be 33 amperes. No one circuit in your house, if you were back feeding, can tolerate 33 amperes, and the generator itself. The way the 4-kilowatt generator, for instance, is designed, in the 240-volt mode, you can get 4 kilowatts out of the generator. Or if you have a pair of independent 120-volt circuits, you can get 2 kilovolt amperes per circuit. You can never get the full 4 kilowatts of that generator out of one single 120-volt circuit. That circuit cannot supply 33 amperes. So even if you buy one that big, you really have to hook it up as a 240-volt wiring system, probably with a transfer relay, unless you think you're smart enough to do all of that with some other technique, but it's not going to be code when you do that. Let me drop to something else going on here. As people like Dave and 2APJ found out, when you've got a undersized generator, like something in the 1,000-watt category, and if you're playing Power Czar, where you're running the things in your house one at a time, you're carefully controlling what runs so that everything doesn't start up at once, 1 kilowatt, 1.5 kilowatts is enough. In the wintertime, my house in Dix Hills, Huntington, Long Island, in the wintertime gave me oil-fired furnace, warm air furnace with its blower motor, oil-fired hot water heater, refrigerator, a medium-sized refrigerator, television set, lights, as long as I control things correctly, 1.5 kilowatt generator did that. And is that enough? Let me show you what else is going on here. You buy a 1 or 1.5 kilovolt ampere generator, because you're not running all of those instruments full blast all the time, your average power you're drawing is something a hell of a lot less than the maximum capability of the generator. You can easily have, with a small generator, a fuel consumption of something in the vicinity of 1.5 gallons per 24 hours. Dave and 2APJ had a generator that, as he says, sips gasoline at that rate, 1.5 gallons per 24 hours. You buy a 5 or 10 kilowatt generator, and even though most of the time it's running a little bit more than idling, so to speak, it's got 5 or 10 kilowatts of capability, and even though you're using less of it, it's going to burn numbers like 5 gallons per day. And that gas can you've got that you filled up only has 5 gallons in it. Does that mean every single day you're going to stand online to refill that can? There are cases where some of these larger generators are burning numbers closer to 10 gallons per day. So because...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because of the degree of difficulty of replacing the petroleum gasoline for your generator, and you're standing online with a whole bunch of other people, and because you've got a real gas guzzler of a generator running in the backyard with lots of kilowatts of capability that you're most of the time, 90% of the time, you're not using, but yet when it's running in its lowest power mode, it's consuming fuel like you wouldn't believe, because that larger engine is turning a hell of a lot more mass, and it's not really required. So as you can tell, there's a significant advantage in the real world of this super sandy storm that we just have to have a smaller generator. And just adding up all the things that you want to power simultaneously is a naive way of looking at it. There's a lot more going on, as you can tell. I didn't say that this is the whole answer. These are just some of the things you've got to consider when you're making a decision of the size of the generator, 220, 440 volt wiring, backfeeding, double wiring, single type extension cord, double extension cord, full backfeeding with the various techniques, or the right way to do it with the transfer switch, and so on. Lots and lots of things to consider. Any further comments that someone wants to make on this one before we go to the next person, give me your call letters right now. KQLIW and the TechNet. Okay, well, as the evening goes on, I guarantee there's going to be more talk on the subject of generators. Tim, WW2W, I think you're living in Keensburg, New Jersey, which is right on the coast. Oh, I'll bet you saw some weather. What was it like there, Tim? WW2W? Oh, wait a minute, I got the wrong guy. Do I have the right guy? Yeah, WW2WW. I wrote it down with only a single W after the number. But you know who you are, Tim. WW2WW, I think it is. KQRIW, you got it, Tim.
Okay, Dick, appreciate that. Good evening to you and the net. Just really had a query about really a general subject that certainly affects each and every one of us. After going through this storm in the last couple of weeks, I was listening to a discussion today about electricity and the grid. And you know, I'm sure at this time there's a lot of people that are starting to learn about the grid and looking at it. And it appears to me that the grid generally in most areas in the Northeast, especially where we live, is really outdated. I mean, when you look at some of our radios that are in front of us over the last couple of years, technology just alone in 20 years is pretty amazing, but yet our overhead wires and our grid and our infrastructure seems to be really non-upgradable. So my question really to you or to the net would be, is there a forum for ideas? Has there been ideas put on the table about grid infrastructure? And is there hope in sight for some kind of upgrading? Because after this storm, looking at all these wires that are just sitting there ready to catch trees, it just doesn't make any sense for me to have wires hang on poles anymore. It just doesn't. You know, I'm 50 years old. Maybe it's just a time efficiency thing. But I just was curious about that. Maybe you could just talk about the grid a little bit, and maybe if you've heard anything about what they're looking to do to upgrade it and boost the infrastructure. WW2WW.
Yeah, Don, good subject, Tim. Our governor, Mr. Cuomo, Mario was his father, why can I not think of his name? You know who I mean. The current governor of New York State has made a lot of... Say again? The current governor of New York State. Somebody tell me his first name.
Andrew.
Well done, Andrew. I knew it, but couldn't think of it. Okay, Andrew has... I'm going to say not as much experience as his father, Mario. As such, he's made a significant number of what I'm going to call derogatory remarks about Long Island Lighting Company and Con Ed and what others as far as the amount of time it takes to restore power. If you're innocent and off to one side and don't quite understand the problem, those are easy things to say and to make that pronouncement. I don't think it's accurate. The contractor that was out in front of my house working for Long Island Power Authority today was removing a tree that was leaning on my particular power drop. In other words, the main power line coming from the pole pig transformer, as it's called, that leads the three wire lead coming into my house, had a tree leaning on it, leaned on it so heavily that wire came down almost to street level without breaking off, thank goodness. And then the snow plows coming down my street had to plow around it. Well, eventually somebody came along to cut away that tree. The particular man cutting away that tree was a contractor hired by Long Island Power Authority to do that work. And with electrical training, he knew what he was doing. He is one of 12,000 employees now on hire doing that work. And I had a chance to discuss things with Mark is his name. And let me drop. Being one of those 12,000 employees, what he has been doing for the last 2.5 weeks, ever since the storm struck, is that he is working a 18-hour day, 6 days a week. Starts at 7 in the morning, quits at 11 o'clock at night, and he was in front of my house in the dark, I guess at around 6 o'clock tonight, cutting away that tree that was leaning on my power line. Came very close to breaking it in my case, in which case I would have been out of power not just for 4 days, but for up until now without ordinary power. In the case of Long Island Power Authority, which used to be Long Island Lighting Company. What they inherited was, let me pick a number, a 70 or an 80-year-old system. The majority of it is above-ground wiring. We can all dream about having below-ground wiring. And that costs roughly $1 million a mile to do it, not counting all the problems of getting the right-of-way, cutting across the front of people's property, worrying about rocks and tree roots. Of the five major trees that fell on my property, two of them were 85-foot-high, 9,000-pound trees. One of them, for instance, was an extremely healthy tree, not a single mark on it from any bugs. This whole 85-foot-high tree, with what I think was over 100-mile-an-hour gusts that hit my property, yanked it out of the ground, laid it flat against the ground with one hell of a thud. Thankfulness it didn't hit the house. A buddy of mine had a house, had a tree like that that hit the house and sliced right through the house, sliced through his garage, injured his cars, as well as heavily damaging the car at the garage. So trees like that coming down can do an awful lot of damage. Wind like this, there's no good way to protect from them. And when they fall across power lines, there's no way you can stop that. They could have trimmed the living daylights out of some of the trees that fell across the power lines. And some of those trees are, let me pick a number, 30.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Some of the trees in my neighborhood that were injuring the power lines were 30 and 40 feet away from the power line, deep into private pieces of property. Are you going to go there and get the permission from that owner and trim those trees and try to avoid them from falling in the worst-case direction across power lines? As you can see, it's a massive problem no matter how you try to correct it ahead of time. You can find ways of making it better. Yes, the communication to the average person who is calling a Long Island Power Authority every hour on the hour saying, when is my power going to be restored? And they weren't getting a direct answer because there was no direct answer. You got 12,000 employees working 18-hour days, 7 days a week, restoring the system. How are you going to use those 12,000 employees? You could take the first 4 days and have them go up and down every single street and just assess how bad the damage is, by which you can make some, you put all of that data into some huge, matrix of some kind, where you eventually come up with estimates as to how long it's going to take to fix it. You can use those 12,000 employees just to assess the damage, or you can say, I know it's bad, I don't know exactly how bad in which areas, I'm going to just choose the higher priority and secondary areas and simply use those people to do the repairs immediately without spending the time doing the assessment. As you can tell, how you use the people is a very difficult decision. No matter how you use them, somebody's going to be unhappy, and some of the more difficult situations are going to be long periods of time before the power is restored. If you're going to make a great big investment in the infrastructure, whether it be the grid or just the local wiring for distribution in your neighborhood, let me drop. If you're going to make a great big investment to improve that system, where's the money going to come from? Long Island Power Authority, because it represents the area of Long Island that used to have the Shoreham Nuclear Station. And the big error that was made is that way back in roughly 1972, Long Island Lighting Company, as it was known at the time, was given permission at the federal level, at the state level, and at the county level. They were given the permission to begin to construct a nuclear power station because all of the available records at the time said this is the rate at which electrical power requirements are going to increase as the population increases, and electrical power by way of nuclear at the time was believed to be the best way to go. They were given permission to do it, and they began the construction. Okay, 20 years downrange, after a whole lot of screaming and hollering of a whole lot of not-in-my-backyard people, we discovered that there's no completely approved evacuation scheme in the case of a worst-case accident at the Shoreham Nuclear Station. Therefore, $7 billion were invested to build that station, and for all practical purposes, it never really went online and was closed down. Who is paying for that? The local ratepayers to some degree. That's part of the reason why the highest rates for electrical power in the United States, the second highest rates, is Long Island Power Authority. The higher one is a private electrical generating station in Hawaii. So when the rates are already rated the highest anywhere in the United States, in the continental United States, where is the money going to come from up beyond those rates to improve the infrastructure? If somebody doesn't come up with a great big funding technique at the state level, I don't think the money is there to do it, or at the federal level, all of this great infrastructure improvement.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Unless somebody can find a great big pot of money, all of these great infrastructure improvements that we can dream about, who in the world is going to fund them, so to speak? So without a doubt, we can do it better. Without a doubt, better communication is possible, more radio. I mean, if there were individual radio sensing systems scattered throughout the system, which allowed you to instantaneously look at some great big computer program and find out exactly where the outages are. That doesn't have to be a huge investment in hardware, and I recommend that. But when it comes to replacing all the above-ground wiring with below-ground wiring, I think it's out of the question. By making some kind of change to the above-ground wiring so that it is more robust and can tolerate some of these falling trees, we can dream about that, but I don't think we're going to get it. So it ain't easy. If you had Solomonic wisdom, Tim, if you had Solomonic wisdom, and if you had a great big pot of money, and you were going to drastically increase the reliability of the power wiring for all of Long Island, and from my point of view, I keep calling Brooklyn and Queens, geographically it's Long Island, even though you guys are really New York City as far as, you think you're New York City. Geographically, you're a Long Island, and yes, you're being fed by Consolidated Edison, but what changes would you make within the constraints that I've just described to you? WW2WWK2RIW in the tech mask.
Well, that was kind of the reason I raised the questions, because it didn't seem easy or plausible or easy or even manageable just to have any kind of major change. And what do you change? And you raised a lot of the roadblocks or red flags to a lot of different approaches, and I'm sure they've been engineers and electrical people have been beating their heads for quite some time to upgrade the system. Just was and expect to have more of a problem than more of an answer. So I'll say I'm humbled by that approach to just find a way to make it better. But I think I like the idea of better management. You know, you didn't see electrical trucks in areas for days. It would be nice to see a little more concerted effort of evaluation. That was a very valid point. That was definitely on my list. But as far as making wires tree catchers, I would be humbled by that.
Yeah. Once you're sitting up at the state level in the governor's office, it's very easy to criticize, because you've got a large number of angry ratepayers who are sitting in a cold house with decaying food, with no heat, with no hot water, no electricity, no television set, in some cases no telephone. They're sitting there, they're very unhappy, and the governor tells them that, yes, I understand you're unhappy, and I'm going to say some terrible things about the power authority because they're not doing a good enough job. They got 12,000 employees doing that work. Under normal circumstances, I think their staff is something like 1,500 people. So they've almost multiplied the number of people by 10 to do the work. They've imported people from California, Florida, Texas, North Carolina. They've imported people, as many as they could get, that they think they could still afford, from faraway places as far as California, these people with the skill to do the work, to do the repairs. If that ain't enough and you're saying they're not doing enough, okay, rather than just criticizing, tell us what you think they should be doing instead. It's very easy to criticize. It's a hell of a lot more difficult to say, if I was in command, I would take the resources you've got, I would take the money you've got, and I would do this instead. We've got to hear more of that, as I see it. To just say that they didn't do a good enough job, okay, to some degree it's true, what should they have done instead? For the most part, you didn't see a whole lot of people just sitting around doing nothing, collecting overtime. There's been a couple of claims along those lines because delivery of hardware didn't take place fast enough, and that was another problem. When you got that much destruction of hardware, where do you get all of those telephone poles and transformers and wires and all these interconnects and so on?
How do you gather enough of that when the whole darn Eastern Seaboard is demanding the exact same material from the exact same suppliers simultaneously? And who do you supply it to first? So everybody likes to live...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
When you're running a large business these days, everybody likes to live with what they call just in time. You want to order the parts just at the time you need them. Because if you have a whole lot of excess parts sitting in a warehouse, you have to pay inventory price on them, you have to pay taxes on them. There's a hell of a lot of incentive not to buy a whole lot of extra hardware. And even if you did do that, the last time we had an event as big as this was Hurricane Gloria, and that was 1985. That was what? 27 years ago. Are you going to have all that excess hardware sitting in a warehouse for 27 years, and you're going to be paying inventory, stocking charge, and taxes on it? No matter how you do it, there's going to be somebody who says, you didn't do it right. Well, tell us how to do it better. And yes, there's going to be some studies. There's going to be some research on this. There's going to be improvements. But just to simply say that these guys didn't do it right, I think that's naive. What you've just heard is a bunch of opinions. You're allowed to express another opinion. Give me a call at us right now, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2MDP.
K2CJE.
I heard MDP and GJE. MDP, go right ahead, Steve.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. I'll say Wilco and all the other line crews from out of state. I mean, I've seen guys as far as Canada, and they're all out there doing a pretty good job. But I will say that as far as what happened, you know, it happened, you know. There's nothing you can really do to stop the devastation. But on the other hand, LIPA always does a Band-Aid fix. In other words, something like this happens, they get people going, and 20 years from now, the same Band-Aid fixes there. You know, there's poles that you go around, you see some of these poles, they look like from the 60s, they're rotted. Some of these temporary splices they make to get people going, they just basically get forgotten about. And that's the one negativity I will say about LIPA. And, you know, what they actually should do is they should go back, you know, once, let's say, this problem is solved, they should go back, and anything that looks bad, that they should repair. Take these temporary fixes, make them permanent, do them right. You know, I've seen a lot of stuff where it's just, you know, slap it together, get it working, make people happy. But then again, they don't go back and correct these problems that are going to be future problems, you know, later on. Back to you.
Okay, you believe, Steve, that an awful lot of what was done was slapdash, just throw it back together and get it operational. I don't quite agree. When it comes to the actual wiring itself, the cables or the wires and the way they get interconnected, everything I see tells me it was done in the normal manner that it should be done. Yes, when it comes to routing telephone poles, and they do exist. And so, at the rate at which you can replace those telephone poles, and where do you buy them from? You and I can complain that the telephone poles that are, in some cases, 20, 30, 40 years old and are rotting away, some of those should be replaced faster. I'm going to agree with you on that one. But when it comes to the majority of the damage that occurred during this event, trees falling across wires, if the telephone pole was weak enough that it snapped, and a few of them did, rotting is a contributing factor, yes. An awful lot of the failure occurred because when you get 9,000 pounds of tree, like some of those trees on my property that fell, 9,000 pounds of tree falling across a wire, no matter how new the telephone pole is, no matter how new that wire is, it's going to snap. So an awful lot of the damage is going to happen ahead of time. So rotting telephone pole, not replaced fast enough, I'm going to agree with you on that one, Steve. But the rest of the wiring, I don't see it. I don't see makeshift techniques. I mean, you and I, as a ham radio operator, might be putting together a failed 80-meter dipole, and we twist the two wires together in the so-called Western Electric twist, and without spending the time of really soldering it. Yes, that's kind of slapdab way of doing it. They didn't do that with power wiring. They're really using the approved interconnect connectors to reconnect two pieces of broken wire. I've seen those kind of splicing devices, and they are...
at code, if you know what I mean. So other than telephone poles themselves that weren't replaced fast enough, what else did you see, Steve, that you think was being done in a slipshod manner? KC2MDP, KC2...
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, in their defense, yeah, a tree falls on some wires, definitely. I don't care what you do. A brand new pole, anything, the tree's heavy enough, it's going to snap the pole, rip the wires out. But I've seen a lot of stuff, you know, and I know they're trying to get stuff back together. And like I said, you know, later on, when things calm down, they should go and replace it. You know, there's a lot of these aluminum drops that go to people's houses, the things that have been up there for 20, 30 years. The aluminum wire is oxidizing. They basically just throw it back up, you know, just anything to get it going. And, you know, stuff like this, it should be replaced, you know. They should make a note of these areas, you know. This is a put-together fix. And it basically they should go back and take care of this stuff. And a lot of the little problems, I'm not saying the major problems with trees and stuff falling, but a lot of the smaller problems would be resolved. You wouldn't have a lot of this stuff. You know, we've done a lot. We're just the lines come out of the house, rip off the house because the aluminum wire is so rotted and stuff. I understand this happens, but rather than put that same piece of rotted out old garbagey aluminum triplex back, they should, you know, throw it back for now, make a note of it, come back, replace it, and a lot of the smaller problems would not happen. Back to you.
Yeah, I think... Let me drop for a second. I think the power company owns the wiring up to the power meter. I believe that's true. I'm going to ask for people to correct me on that one. So all of the power distribution system up to the power meter, I think, is their side, and then beyond that, we own it. However, across the street from me, there's a couple of people who own a piece of property that's got a crazy shape to it, where the house is 150 yards back from the street. Does all of that 150 yards with those intermediate above ground poles, is that also the responsibility of the power company? Or does that somehow enter into the responsibility of the private citizen? Can anybody correct me on that one? Give me a call, letters and name. K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2MDP.
Okay, I heard both John and Steve in that order. John, KC2WGB in Staten Island, is it also a similar technique where Con Ed owns the wiring up to the power meter? No matter how far back on the property that wiring goes, you got it, John.
Yes, Dick, unless you have an underground system, they're responsible for an underground system to the property line box. After that, it's your responsibility. Now, on an overhead, they're responsible up to the weatherhead. That's how it is on Staten Island.
Okay, that's good to know. Up to the weatherhead. And in my case, the weatherhead then has a piece of wire that goes down to the power meter. And I guess you're saying that vertical piece of wire is my responsibility. So it's not quite up to the power meter. Up to the weatherhead. Let's see what Steve's got to say on that one. KC2MDP, K2RAW, you got it, Steve.
Yeah, that's exactly correct, Dick. Yeah, same thing here on Long Island. Yep, right to the weatherhead. That drop that comes to your house, that's maintained by LIPA. Of course, the meter's maintained by LIPA. And if it's on the ground, exactly up to the box in the yard. Anything that's buried on the ground on your property is your responsibility. Back to you.
Same thing in Jersey. WS2N, I have on the ground.
What was that, Paul? WS2N, repeat that statement of yours, Paul.
LIPA, you know, their responsibility is right up to the meter, including anything under my ground.
I hear you. Okay, Mr. GJE, I missed the prefix of your call, sir. Mr. GJE, please give me your full call. I should know your name, but I don't. And then your comment. You've got a GJE, K2RIW.
Many people use LIPA. Some of them are Verizon.